Welcome to the Talent Smart Podcast. Our intention in each episode is to interview interesting and inspiring people who will offer their insights into their areas of expertise. We want to explore how technology and business can improve and enhance the world. We're always keen to hear from you and let us know what topics you'd like to hear us cover in future episodes. Also, if you'd like to take part, please let us know. We're always looking for interesting and inspiring people to interview. Speak soon. Hello, everyone, and welcome again. Thank you for joining us. I am delighted today. I've got a good friend and somebody I've known for a long time who's decided to give me some time, which has been brilliant, and I really appreciate it. I'd like to welcome my good friend and somebody that a lot of you will already know, Jorah Gill, clearly, obviously, former CXO of big organizations, The Economist, Standard & Poor's, Elsevier, great career going through there, and now a board member of the FTSE 250, Travis Perkins, board member of the CQC, the Care Quality Commission, and now the CEO of Insights Driven. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Phil. Pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's we've known each other such a long time. It seems really odd to formally introduce you like that, but I think it's for people, it's always nice for people who don't know you. So I'm really interested to hear a little bit more about Insights Driven and what you're doing, because I think there's something here for everyone. I think we could start with a little snapshot of what is it you're doing, and then we'll dig into a little bit of what we've entitled this is how to avoid the 1 million disaster, which I think is a great title, and it'll probably encourage people to watch and listen and maybe avoid some of the potholes that you've learned and the scars. Because as I often say, somebody of your experience, people, they buy into you and want to listen to you for your scars, not your stars. So what is Insights Driven? Because a little overview would be great.
Yeah, a 30-second overview of Insights Driven. The complexity of these million-plus projects is getting higher and higher, and I'll go into some of the details of why I think that is. But we're essentially a risk analytics firm. We look at digital transformation, digital change programs, and we look at the risks up front. So we give you a better chance of succeeding, and we also know that removing risk early on improves the speed of innovation and feedback later on. So that's sort of our 30 seconds of what Insights Driven is.
Oh, that's brilliant. And I mean, you've obviously got a career, a great CV, spanned across some major organizations. And I've been involved as a supplier to some of those innovative, initiatives that you've been part of and delivered and been in charge of. Over the course of your career, would you say the rate of project failures has gone up in the last sort of, I won't say how many years you've been doing this, but in let's say in the last 20 years, has project failure rate gone up, do you think, or has it gone down?
I think product and product improvement is actually reducing. The risks of failure is actually reducing when you're iterating on an existing established product and building new features. That's actually, improving thanks to techniques like Agile and A/B testing. I think large projects, actually the failure rate is either consistent or gets worse. So the Standish Research Group has been reporting for the last 15 years that the failure rate of large programs to deliver on the promises they offered is at 69%. So nearly 70%, 70% of large projects, and that's, saying 1 million plus projects have a 70 chance of failing, and failing on budget, on time, or realizing the value, the business case that they were sort of set up to do. That's just not improved. And I've got lots of thoughts on why that is.
So just to reiterate that, 70% of 1 million plus pounds or dollars project do not meet the expected outcomes.
Exactly. And it's the Standish Reports statistics. You can Google them. They're sort of out there. They've been reporting year and year on the failure rates of projects. And it's just not improving. And that's, even with new techniques like Agile, all the new technologies we have, all the upskilling we've gone through, but it's just not improving.
And why do you think that is? What are the sort of drivers behind that, do you think?
I think the world has got more complex. So if we take technology from, as a start, there's newer technologies being introduced that we don't have awareness of. AI is fairly new. Some people, claim to really understand it, and other people are still learning it. You add then quantum computing, metaverse, edge computing, Web 3.0, and it's all these technologies that are being thrown at us. There's an interesting schematic of all the product marketing tools out there right now. There's, I think, Gartner produce it, and there's hundreds of product marketing. So the amount of choice is really quite complex. The other one is the customer is changing. So there used to be a point in time where you knew more than the customer, and the customer's buying your products pre-internet, and now the customer actually has done more research than yourself. So when the customer is asking questions about your product or your solution, they actually have more access to information. So it's sort of that's changed. The other thing is the roles that we have. So when I started off my career, basically you had a project manager, you had a business analyst, and you had some engineers. Now we have project manager, scrum master, program manager, DevOps, SysOps, UX expert, CX expert, and those sort of, and because of the complexities of the way the products are developed now, there's a lot more skill. Now, what's the point of that? That's a more complex team to bring together. So now you're trying to bring these cross-functional teams together. Now, at the same time, the rate of competition is increasing. So new market entrants or your existing competitors who are muscling up, and all of a sudden, your customers are sort of seeing things that your competitors are offering, and the switch costs have gone lower, so they can just switch from bank A to bank B in a matter of minutes. So all of those complexities added together are sort of some of the reasons why we're seeing the failure rates just not improve.
Yeah, I can imagine. So you've been asked to deliver things much quicker, but at the same time, then you've got more complex teams to be having to manage. The switch cost is interesting. I hadn't even thought about that. So the cost for people to switch provider or switch product or buy from someone else has gone down. So that's something I've not really gone through before or even heard of before. So could you just expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, so by switch costs, I mean if somebody is product, say bank A, and bank B is offering some capabilities, the switch costs to switch have gone easier because you can change your bank, you know, in a matter of minutes. But actually interesting, our research actually showed that people aren't switching because they've got a relationship with their existing bank, even though they're not happy with them, they still trust their bank more so than maybe going to an unknown bank with their personal savings. And they're still worried about, will I get paid on time and will it hit my bank? So when we're looking at, say, product and product strategy, we normally start off, one of our de-risking is not to start off with features and design and UX and CX. It's really to start off with who is your ideal customer? Like, who are you trying to attract? Let's get into, the mindset of that ideal customer. What is the price point that they're willing to switch over to your product? And even if the price point is right, are they fearful of the switch between product A and product B? And so our research is actually showing, actually adding more and more features is sometimes the wrong side of the coin to start with. Where we recommend you start with is user research. And so switch costs have got a lot easier, but people aren't switching. And it has to be something that's quite unique for them to switch over from their existing supplier to their new one. So we're sort of really working with a lot of product teams to sort of say, features are great and we'll get to features, but let's start with the persona of the customer, either your existing customer or the new customers that you're trying to attract. And what is causing them pain right now, which would cause them to switch over to a new provider?
Yeah, that's amazing, actually, when you think about it, because it's almost like you've got to go fishing in somebody else's pool. So you've got to use the right bait. You've got to make sure that it's, it's going to be attractive, and then try and hook them in to sort of experiment with you a little bit and say, well, actually, look, I'll remove this pain from you. So I know I like that. What about in terms of things that maybe could be identified within a business or within a major £1 million plus project? Are there any sort of common themes that you've identified there at Insights Driven that people need to look at to avoid the risk of failure?
Yes, I think when going back to my sort of early career, we used to be organized in sort of departments. So, I was at an investment bank, BNP Paribas and Credit Suisse, and I was at the technology department, and there was a middle office, a back office, and a front office. And because the rate of change, you know, was not as fast and as innovative right now, it was quite easy. We used to have the waterfall was the feature then, and I'm still a fan. And so, but we would pass these documents from a functional specification and from the business across to the technology. Technology would deliver and produce. Now that's become a lot more complex right now. As I said earlier, the market is moving at such a rate, the macro market, the market outside of your organization, is moving at such a speed, the rate, that you're not sure how to respond, and your response has to sort of be faster than it was when we were using waterfall. Hence why these techniques on lean and agile are really playing a part in MVP and A/B testing and all of that sort of good stuff. But what we're finding is the insights of why that market's moving has to come from a multidisciplinary team. So most multidisciplinary or cross-functional teams seem to us to be set up mainly in the technology division. So you'd have product, UX, engineering, DevOps. The bit that we sort of, you know, and part of why the 69% failure rate, the bit that we don't see is the business having part of that multidisciplinary. So the best organizations we see, marketing could be in there, sales could be in there, operations could be there. You're creating a business plan together. So you may be spending 10 million on a new CRM system. Now, as a head of engineering, a CIO, a CTO, whatever the title is, you want to be working in partnership with the business going, okay, we're going to spend 10 million on our new CRM system, but are we going to see a 10% lift of our top line or our bottom line? And we're going to sign this business case together, and we're going to develop this business case together. And that doesn't tend to happen in a lot of organizations that we sort of go into. It seems very much we're putting in, you know, Salesforce, but then you haven't really connected it to the business case. And then also what we find is on one side, it's an unequal that you've signed up as the technology leader to this business case, but you haven't really scoped it yet. And, you know, this is where I go back to waterfall versus agile. And the business of working in a very waterfall, like we want everything and we're not sort of, you know, moving back. And you're saying we're in agile and we'll do the must-haves and we'll leave the nice-to-haves. So I think that is quite important that you sort of create this sort of ways of working together up front. And you have a joint partnership and you're very honest at the beginning. So that's one. I think that sort of end-to-end cross-functional team is the other one. The second point is you've got the most important person not in the loop, and that is the customer. So often we see, you know, these great products. I'm working with a company that's produced one of the best health products I've ever seen, but the customer's not buying it. And we're sort of going, okay, where was the customer in the journey in creating these products? And we're going, well, we thought there was a gap in the market and we thought this would be addressed. Customer, I mean, if you look at Amazon, they are the masters of having the customer, and everything they're customer obsessed, every question they ask is around the customer. So having the customer in the loop. So when we were at The Economist, we created a fantastic app called Expresso, which is your daily read of The Economist, 5 minutes on Expresso, and you've read it. The amount of user research we did that on that before even writing a single requirement or single feature or a single line of code was probably 20 to 30% of the project life. So, and we knew we'd nailed it, and that was a very successful product. So having the customer in the loop is really important. The third element, Phil, I would say is balancing risk versus balancing speed of innovation. So often we see projects that sort of, you know, are going to sort of radically change a market, you know, change sort of your growth strategy, change your cross sell upsell strategy. And it's always really thought of as the up case. But I like to start with, you know, a post-mortem. So I'd like to say, okay, let's talk about why did the project fail or why did the product not sort of innovate? So let's start with that. So at every single point, you're talking about risk. You're talking about risk, 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 until you've actually launched the project. And then it's actually very easy to launch the project and the product, be it internal product or external product. So just starting with risk in mind, so balancing that yo-yo, as we say in Insights Driven, balancing the complexity of change with the promise of innovation, keeping that seesaw is quite critical. If you go too far on innovation, you sort of created something that nobody's really interested in. If you go too far on risk, you're never really getting anything out the door because you're sort of dotting the I's and crossing the T's. So that balance is quite important. So that would be the third element, I would say.
Yeah, and that's interesting, that risk bit, because I suppose for a lot of people, where's your starting point in understanding your risk? Is it previous projects post-mortem, as you say, or is there, we're planning on releasing a new product and we've done our customer evaluation, and what then? How do I know that, how can I make myself bulletproof? Is there any way, or is there, I mean, obviously I know you need more detail to be able to answer that question, but is there sort of a quick answer to that question?
The tips I would give and what we found is to really sort of understand, spend a lot of time sort of just doing an assessment of your risk. So by assessment, I mean a set of questions that you can think of risk across those cross-functional sort of teams. So, you know, the risk could be, you know, you don't have enough capacity in your team or the right skills. Come and talk to Bill Phantom and Talent Smart because you haven't got the data strategy people or data architecture people are sort of maxed out anyway, and you need to bring in those skills. Your third party sort of vendor, if you're using a third party vendor, maybe acting as a supplier, and really for this project, you want them to act as a partner. Sit down with your provider and explain to them, this is what we're trying to achieve, and we want to get your thoughts, given that you've done so many projects with other clients. What are the best practices? Involve the business right up front in that risk. So don't present the risks to the business, but involve them. So one of the risks could be the business major stakeholder who's got a lot of the IP knowledge of what you're trying to build for the new market where you're building a new product, upsell, cross-sell, or sort of build new sort of revenue, may not be available because they're working on some other initiative. At that point, I would sort of say, if that's the person you need, I would stop the project. It's such a major risk. And I would say, let's halt it until they're ready. It's better to do that than overspend on your project and then blame. And I think it's not up to the technology department just to present the risks. I think it should be a two-way. So I think the business should be presenting business risks, technology risks, and et cetera. So that would be the sort of other recommendation I would do. But definitely start with that assessment, and then involve the customer, or, you know, do some user research. So example is we had produced a very fancy wireframe app. We did user research, but we weren't asking the right questions. And we learned from that, and I've learned in my career to ask, you know, really insightful questions. So the question was, you know, what do you think of this app? What do you think of the features? What do you think of the usability? And it was all thumbs up. The questions I didn't ask at the time was, would you be willing to pay $19.99 per month for this app? And overwhelmingly, as we found when we sort of put that into market, the answer was no. So really involving people, but asking those difficult questions as well in that upfront assessment is the tip I would give.
Oh, that's brilliant. And actually, we do see quite a bit of that. That later in the process, when we're asked to get involved, that the resource planning has been not very effective. So onboarding very high demand skills, thinking that it's a case of calling a Talent Smart or somebody else, and we can have the, you know, contractors on board within a week. And sometimes those in demand skills take longer and they're more costly than it's in the plan. So there's a risk factor there too. That's interesting. So there's some themes and there's some sort of quick wins. What about the sort of tools and techniques? I mean, what have you used in your time to sort of mitigate against failure as much as possible?
Yeah, so I've had quite a few failures. I'm only 25 and look at me. Yeah.
failure in a paper round then, a real tough paper round.
I was, yes, always late and over budget. But I think back in, believe it or not, Phil, back in about 2008, 2009, I was featured on this magazine called CIO Magazine. I don't know if you remember it.
And I was sort of, you were Standard & Poor's at the time.
I was at Standard & Poor's, and I was the poster child for Agile, like where Agile is going to sort of change, you know, the ways of working. But I've found over time that I've sort of subdued my thinking. I think Agile is fantastic for, you know, new product thinking, where, you know, change is iterative, so a website or an app. But actually, I'm sort of falling back to sort of waterfall when it comes to very large change programs like CRM systems. I mean, Agile was good because you didn't really know what the customer wanted. So you were continuing doing MVPs to get and collecting data to improve the product for the market need. A sort of CRM system where you're moving from system A to system B with maybe new capability. Agile really is a struggle there. So I would say, look at the techniques that you're using for project delivery. Really think it through before you start those projects. That's sort of one sort of technique. So everything, you know, the answer can't be agile or waterfall to everything, and it may be a blend in both of those. When it comes to techniques for product development, always start with product strategy, never start with product development. I'm not a big fan of this terminology, product development, because it just sounds like you really know everything that needs to go on and you really haven't thought it. The other technique I would do is in product, if you're a B2B business, try to get an anchor client, try to get one client who is willing to share, and a lot of clients actually are, willing to share some of the unknowns and some of the journey along with you. You may give them a discount or some form of discount there. I think the other one is actually, you know, the way you're onboarding people. I sort of find that, you know, onboarding is really, you know, when I started, when I started an investment bank, my first sort of 8 to 10 weeks was reading manuals about how derivatives work, how vanilla options work, how cash equities work. And they wouldn't let me loose on any, I was a developer then, any code until I'd really understood the context of what I was doing. A lot of that seems to be sort of thrown away because everybody's fast tracking, or they think they're fast tracking things. Spending that time, even if it's a contractor coming on, spending a week of onboarding, really telling them the context, really sort of saying, this is what we're trying to do, giving them the opportunity to share some of their knowledge in questions and answers, will actually increase your innovation speed. Your velocity will go up if you're just spending a few weeks with the teams describing what you're doing. And it just, you know, and sometimes if you're a sort of QA or software engineer, you have no idea what you just asked to write code, but you really need to understand, you know, so what is the strategy here? What are we doing with the products and who's the product on? With that, software engineer or QA will actually sort of come back with a lot of initiatives back to you. So I think it's how we treat people and how we involve people. And the best companies in the world really spend a lot of time storytelling and describing to everybody. And if there's resistance, that's good. Better to de-risk that resistance up front. So those are some of the techniques and tools that I found really work.
Now, that's brilliant. I mean, definitely in some of the companies that we work with, where they have the most success and joy is if they can connect the company purpose or the team purpose to the customer and output as well. So they actually get to see and know that when you're doing something as a QA developer, the outcome is Mr. or Mrs. Jones here and their impact is this. I did know a bank one time, and the CISO actually brought all of the security team and they played videos of some of their customers and asked them what would happen if there was an outage. And, you know, and there'd be a baker shop who said, well, actually, we would, you know, if there's an outage for a week, it might put us out of business. And the motivation in the team just went through the roof.
You're 100% right. And sort of we've also been looking at retention data. And really, I think it's about third or fourth we were looking at was pay. First was that sense of purpose. Now, people talk about the millennials, you know, and the Gen Y and Gen Z. But I think it's for everybody. I think having a sense of purpose, a cause, a mission really brings teams together. So that sense of purpose is sort of when people aren't quite sure if they're adding any value into the organization, if they're making a difference or the organization. And one of the things you asked me earlier, Phil, you know, what have I seen change? And I gave you that example of my first 8 to 10 weeks at the investment bank learning all these new sort of derivatives, etc. I think, and I haven't got data behind this one, but I think we're spending less on training and investment. I think there's so much going on right now. Up to a point, I believe that individuals have to train themselves and really invest in themselves. But at the same time, I find organizations, you know, the first thing that gets cut is the training and investment budget when you're sort of going through to your 2023 budgets. It's the first thing that gets cut. And then you're sort of asking halfway through, why are my product people, you know, not as good as I'd hope they do? Because you haven't invested in your product people or your data strategy people, or your enterprise architect people, and you're actually paying for that sort of 200,000 or 500,000 shave, because what you don't shave are the product ideas. You don't sort of say, let's just cut off that product idea and let's use that money to invest. The best companies in the world, I would hedge a bet, they're also the biggest companies that invest and provide innovation time to their teams.
No, 100%. I would absolutely agree with that. And so it's interesting that there's a theme coming out here that maybe smaller teams are more innovative and they can react quicker and they've got better communication, better purpose maybe. Is that one of the reasons why, what are the key concepts or reasons behind why large projects tend to fail and smaller projects tend to succeed?
Yeah, I mean, large projects just by their nature are just more complex projects. And therefore the smaller sort of product initiatives where you have a team of 7 plus or minus 2, you know, they're very grounded in, you know, really understanding their customers, their products, and understanding their capabilities. And they're also used to each other. They know, you know, the strengths and the weaknesses, and they're willing to cover that. Large projects, actually, you're bringing in teams sometimes who've never met to each other. Yeah, you may be bringing in a third party on your new finance system, and you haven't taken the trouble of getting to know each other, and you haven't really taken the trouble of sort of understanding, you know, where the risks sort of lie. So you're treating your large project exactly the same as a small project, and this is what some of our risks come out like. And why I was talking about agile, you can't always just take the same tools and techniques that are working on a small project and expect them to work on a larger project. They just don't sort of operate. If me and you are sort of, you know, driving to sort of Birmingham, we may do a certain amount of planning and we know we'll roughly get there, you know, 15 or 20 minutes within, you know, that's sort of what we thought. Now, if me and you are sort of asked to fly a spaceship to the moon, we'd probably do a bit more planning. We wouldn't sort of just sort of jump into sort of the spaceship and go, hey, Phil, you know, Google is sort of saying we should reach the moon sort of about 2:30. So good to go. We would do a lot more prep. And I think looking at organizations like NASA and the type, how they operate, I think the military are great examples of planning large projects, but also planning the things that sort of can go wrong in sort of large sort of operations. So NASA is always looking at risk. So if you ever read about them, and I know you're a big fan in this area, Phil, they're always doing what if scenarios constantly. And they've almost got a playbook of what to do if something goes wrong or who to go and talk to. I think what we see missing in large projects is, where's your playbook? And when we ask for the playbook, when we're doing our sort of risk assessment, I'd say one in sort of something like 50 companies have actually got a playbook. And so we're then sort of saying, let's start by creating the playbook, and then we'll start the project. And those things, you know, just don't seem to exist. And I think that's why larger projects seem to fail, is complexity of teams, not realizing whose role is what, having done a RACI, don't have a playbook, and using techniques that are for smaller projects to be applied for something a lot more complex.
So let's say that there's people watching this now and they're project or program manager. I'm going to use the phrase bogged down, but they're knee deep minimum. I was going to use another phrase, but I won't, in case there's younger viewers. they're knee deep in a project, and it is not very pleasant and it's not looking good. Other than obviously clearly seek out insights driven, what are your options? What should you do? I mean, what's your sort of, if we wrap up with this, is in terms of your advice piece, your go-to Jorah Gill's wisdom, I'm in the doo-doo, what do I do?
Yeah, so I mean, sort of what I've seen from my experience is usually those folks, you know, are sort of just trying to get out the doo-doo, to use your terminology, and they're going to pass that problem on to somebody else. So if you're a project manager, you'll say, hey, look, your estimates were incorrect and it's your fault that, you know, we're now running late. And actually the role of a project manager is, you know, part of it. And so, and I think a lot of this is down to culture. I think we can write all about techniques, all about tools, but if you don't have the culture where you can have empathy, honesty, open debate, I think you've got an organization that you're working off fear. And so how do you reduce that fear or eliminate that fear? Still understanding that everybody's got a job to do in this baton race or football team or whatever analogy you want to use. And we're all specialists in, you know, our area of expertise. But at the same time, we need to come together as a team and reflect. So one of the biggest bits missed out in Agile as we look at it is the lessons learned. So everybody's doing velocity and burn down and stand up. And we go in and we're going, okay, could you show us your lessons learned documents for the past 3 months on this project? And they're like, oh, you know, we did have a meeting at the end of this. And I think with those lessons learned, it creates a sort of what's working, what's not working. Let's be open and learn from each other. But then the second thing we miss is going, oh, yeah, great, lessons learned, you're really good. So now can you show us the action log that you've sort of applied to this lesson learned? That we very rarely see. We see lessons learned in big Word documents, and there's no action logs. So coming back to my board experience, when you're in a board, one of the things we do is we always start the meeting with the previous board meeting's action logs. Every board meeting in this country and any other country will always start there. Then the next page is usually about risks, and then they'll get to the board sort of, you know, discussion and topics of the day. That's how they're structured, and I think we should take a lot of elements that boards are already doing very well, because they are the guardians of risk, really. That's what their role is, you know. So I think taking some of those board experience elements, creating that sort of diverse, inclusive, empathetic, low ego, lack of fear, but open and innovative, you know, organization, it all comes down to culture, Phil. And there's techniques that you can create a great culture. I'll be going on for another 3 hours on how to create that culture, but there are techniques on how you can do this.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, look, Jura, it's been an absolute delight, as it always is, spending some time with you. I really appreciate you being kind enough to give us some time today. And I look forward to, I hope we can get together again and talk about some of the other topics, which I know you're passionate about in terms of major projects and how to help people deliver on them. But for now, Jura Gill, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Phil.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the Talent Smart podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. We're always keen to hear your feedback. Please let us know your thoughts and what episodes and what topics you'd like to hear us cover in the future. Our intention in each episode is to interview interesting and inspiring people who offer their insights into their areas of expertise. We're keen to hear from you. Please let us know your thoughts and if you'd like to take part in future episodes.